hear a lot of politicians talk about healthcare, asking why the U.S. can't just try a simple universal system like Canada's.
We actually have 13 provincial and territorial healthcare systems. Another thing that people sort of misunderstand is that a lot of things are actually paid for through private health insurance in Canada.
So maybe it's not so simple north of the border. I'm Marco Werman. Also, the Brexit question turns existential.
And of course, the other thing that's unresolved is the legacy of empire. You know, we thought this was all over, but it turns out it has a kind of zombie afterlife.
Plus, a baby white rhino is born thanks to fertility treatments. The future of a nearly extinct species might rest on his little back. No pressure, kiddo. Those stories and much more today here on The World. Everybody loves Canada all of a sudden, at least on the 2020 campaign trail.
5 minutes away from here, John, is a country. It's called Canada. They guarantee health care to every man, woman.
That was Bernie Sanders during last night's debate, in which questions about health care took center stage. Then today, the Trump White House said it would let Americans buy lower-cost prescription drugs from Canada. It's not yet clear how that would work, but some Canadians are already sounding the alarm. They say the change could lead to drug shortages. So what about health care in Canada? For a reality check, we turn to Karen Grapin. She's a health system specialist in Ontario.
So in Canada, rather than having a single national healthcare system, we actually have 13 provincial and territorial healthcare systems. Mm. Another thing that people sort of misunderstand about Canada is that some people like to say that we have a single payer healthcare system. And that's true for some things, but actually we have a very multi-payer healthcare system in Canada, and that a lot of things are actually paid for through private health insurance in Canada. What keeps the system together is there are sort of basic rules that outline what the minimum standards must be.
Has healthcare always been like this in Canada?
No, I mean, I would define always.
Right.
In 1984, we passed the Canada Health Act. And so when I'm referring to the healthcare system today, I'm basically referring to a healthcare system that was based on those minimum standards that were introduced in 1984. So, for example, if you are a resident or a citizen of Canada, you are entitled to coverage. What that coverage might be can be different, but everybody is covered. And then for the most part, there is comprehensive coverage of hospital and physician services.
As you said, this all started kind of in 1984. So what came before 1984 and what prompted in Canada what we kind of know today as universal coverage? Does the origin story look like what the U.S. is currently facing?
I mean, the stories obviously differ. Up until the 1950s, there wasn't a lot of coverage of anything anywhere in Canada. There was a lot of innovations happening in a province called Saskatchewan. There was a premier at the time, Tommy Douglas, who was very concerned about citizens of Saskatchewan suffering undue financial hardship because of having to access the hospital. And so he made it a big push to ensure that these costs were covered. And so, for example, he introduced the first hospital insurance scheme anywhere in Canada. And different provinces were doing things differently. And so there was a push for the federal government to try to encourage provinces to do something about that. That led to, for example, cost sharing. So they would say, well, if you introduce health insurance in your province, we'll pay for half. And so they incentivized the provinces to take on these different levels of coverage. But it didn't necessarily have to be uniform. It was only in 1984 when this Canada Health Act was passed, was the idea that things, these minimum standards had to be enforced everywhere.
It sounds a little like Medicaid. Help us understand, though, Karen, why some people in Canada need or opt for private insurance.
One of the ideas of comprehensive coverage is that if things are, quote unquote, medically necessary, then they need to be covered by public services. However, if they're not medically necessary, then there can be private insurance to cover those things. Back in 1984, paying for drugs was not a big deal. There was a very different patent law system in place. Drugs were not very expensive. And as a result, they were not included under what's known as medically necessary. Nor were things like private hospital rooms or physiotherapy or even mental health services. Mm. And so those things are not covered under the Canada Health Act and therefore not typically paid for through the public purse. And so as a result, there's pretty high levels of private insurance coverage across Canada.
So final question. You've lived in the U.S. Would you hold up the Canadian model for the U.S. as it looks to improve the system here?
I wouldn't, actually. I think there are many different ways to get to the idea of universal health coverage. We see examples like Germany that does it through social health insurance, which is a lot like Medicare in the United States. A lot of countries that do it through tax financing, like the United Kingdom, and that's very much like the Medicaid model. And then there's Switzerland that does it through private health insurance. It really comes down to how you can go from what you have today to what you need to change to make things better. Shifting to something that looks like the Canadian healthcare system would be very challenging. But that doesn't mean that changes can't be made to make improvements, or particular lessons could be taken from the Canadian system to make improvements in the United States.
Karen Grapin at Wilfrid Laurier University in Ontario, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi addressed a different legislative body today. She was speaking in the Parliament of Ghana in West Africa. Pelosi's address comes on the 400th anniversary of the first enslaved Africans arriving in America. She also spent time this week visiting some of the historic sites of the slave trade on Ghana's coast.
At Cape Coast Castle, we stood before the door of no return, where countless millions caught their last glimpse of Africa before they were shipped to a life of enslavement. Being here has been a transformative experience for all of us.
The World's Rupa Shenoy just got back from Ghana, where she was reporting on the origins of the transatlantic slave trade. Rupa, what kind of anticipation was there for Pelosi's visit?
While I was there, the news actually came out that she was coming. And I'm pretty sure that I ran into her advance team at Elmina Castle.
What is it that they want to remove the bottles?
Yes.
Are you Nancy Pelosi's advance team?
I can't. We're here with the embassy. We always bring people out here.
Huh. Yeah, well, an advance team will rarely admit they're the advance team. So this was Elmina Castle in Ghana. Anyone who's ever been there knows the emotional power and impact of the place. What is the significance of Elmina Castle?
This is where Africans were kept sometimes for months before they were put on ships and sold across the world. And the lower levels are the dungeons. And the air is heavy. The ceilings are low. It's dark. It almost gives you a panic attack even being in there. And then the top floors where the administrators were are airy. And you can hear the waves. And it's like a vacation.
It's perched right over the water. Right?
Yeah, it's a resort. You look down and it's almost like the castle is on the water itself.
Slavery and reparations are in the air right now. Came up a couple of times last night at the Democratic debates, and it is part of the conversation now heading into the 2020 elections. What does that conversation sound like in Ghana?
Nothing like it does here. I mean, because there was not only a European role in the slave trade, there was also a very large African role in the slave trade. I mean, Africans are the ones who captured other Africans and sold them to the Europeans. And there's a lot behind that. There's a lot that nuance and culture and a lot to talk about there that we will talk about when I bring all this to you as stories in a few weeks. But very recently, they've begun to acknowledge their role, some of the leaders. And so they do, like the tour guides in Elmina Castle, they say, you know, Africans were the ones that sold other Africans into the slave trade. But then they very quickly move on. And a lot of people do. They're all about saying, it happened. It was awful. We endured it together. We want to move past this because we just want you to come here and help us improve our country.
Fascinating stuff. So what message do you think Nancy Pelosi is sending by going to Ghana right now?
So she is there for the year of return. Ghana, the government, has declared this the year of return. So it's asking.
Meaning what?
They're asking them for the African diaspora to come back. And they're doing it this year because this year marks 400 years since the first enslaved Africans were brought to the English colonies in the Americas. So you could say it's the beginning of American slavery. And I think by going there, she's drawing the comparison about what's happening today, like Trump's tweets about Elijah Cummings and Baltimore, and drawing a line from that to history. And when you do it that way, it seems like, you know, the continuation of a long tradition of racism.
So when Ghana is inviting these African Americans back, is it to visit or to stay and live?
to stay and live. Mm-hmm. And that's a very complicated invitation because there's a lot of culture. It's a lot to take in. Even the visit there is just really emotional, especially to these slave castles. I asked Cynthia McCroy. She's from Omaha, Nebraska. If she was imagining her ancestor at this place.
I can't imagine. I can't imagine. All I can do is try and carry the story forward so that we will always understand how strong, because the people that made it to the Americas had to be strong to have endured all of this and still made it.
That was Cynthia McCroy from Omaha, Nebraska. And you're going to hear a lot of people saying things like that and a lot from the African side when we go into these stories in a few weeks.
I can't wait to hear them. The world's Rupa Shenoy, just back from Ghana. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you, Marco.
Tourists have been flocking to the Austrian Alps for a long time. Stunning views of those mountains and the 1965 blockbuster, The Sound of Music, no doubt inspired visitors. But the attraction of a perfect Instagram post takes tourism to another level. Just ask the locals in the Austrian village of Hallstatt. The BBC's Bethany Bell has a story.
The mountains are pretty cool. The river is really, it's a fabulous place.
Exotic,
but so many people.
Yeah.
Hallstatt, which is perched on the shores of a mountain lake, is something of an alpine dream. And over the last 10 years, it's seen a huge increase in the number of tourists here. Up to 8,000 visitors, 10 times the population here, arrive every day.
We heard it from some apps in China, and many people recommended the place, so we came here. And many people posted some beautiful photos. More and more people want to come here and want to know if it's true.
Hallstatt is breathtakingly beautiful. Steep, rocky mountains leading down to a beautiful alpine lake. And the village itself is full of 17th and 18th century houses with wooden chalet-style roofs and petunias and geraniums hung around the terraces and balconies. The mayor, Alexander Scheutz, says tourism has been great for Hallstatt's economy.
The advantages are that we have become financially independent. We used to be a place that people left. We couldn't balance our budget. But that's changed. Now we can develop our own projects and offer a lot to our population. Many things which we couldn't afford, but which are now good for our inhabitants.
Wandering through Hallstatt, you see a number of houses which have signs saying private, no entry on them. A number of the locals here find the sheer number of tourists difficult to cope with, including Rudolf.
We have a lot of short-term visitors who swamp the place and then leave after 2 or 3 hours. That isn't so good for the people who live here. The disadvantages are obstructions and rubbish. And sometimes the tourists push into private areas, and that isn't pleasant for anyone.
Das ist natürlich für niemand angenehm.
Many of the visitors reach Hallstatt by tour buses, which arrive here every few hours. The mayor says there are plans to reduce the number of coaches. But mass tourism, it seems, is here to stay.
The BBC's Bethany Bell reporting in beloved and slightly beleaguered Hallstatt, Austria. We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. From France to Venezuela, from the U.S.-Mexico border to Hong Kong, we've been hearing a lot about tear gas lately. That's tear gas being fired at a recent protest in Hong Kong. Here's the thing. Tear gas was ruled illegal in wartime a long time ago. So why is it okay to fire it at civilians? Jamil Dakwar is the director of the ACLU Human Rights Project. I asked him, first of all, how tear gas works.
Well, the tear gas is really a chemical weapon. It is a material that has been developed very early on in the First World War and caused the deaths of thousands of people. Then it was developed into a more modern tear gas. It causes a serious burning and feeling of suffocation and, you know, obviously tearing. It's used now more massively than ever by law enforcement.
Are there different classes of tear gas? I mean, is there tear gas today that's being used on civilians that is not lethal?
Well, it is considered a less lethal weapon when it's used in outdoor in general. It could be lethal. In fact, there are incidents where people were killed by these canisters. The problem with the tear gas, it's also an indiscriminate weapon. If you think about the way that it's being deployed, it doesn't really distinguish between, you know, young people and elderly, the healthy and the sick, people who are peaceful protesters or those who are using violence. But the idea is that, you know, this has become the first trigger, the first thing that law enforcement would use as if it is going to be the way to de-escalate and to end the protest. Most of the time it's really used to suppress protests. And that's really one of the fundamental problems with that.
Jamil, why do you at the ACLU see tear gas as a problem?
Well, we've seen over the years, and the ACLU has been monitoring the use of tear gas by law enforcement for decades. We have unfortunately seen not only the use of tear gas by law enforcement, but also by border patrol agents against migrants. It was used against families and children who were asylum seekers. And children in particular are more vulnerable to tear gas because tear gas is heavier than the air, so it really stays on the ground. And their lung is smaller, obviously, so they usually are the first casualties of such weapons. So we have been very concerned about the deployment of tear gas, and we hope that those images that we see around the world from Puerto Rico to Hong Kong and in the United States, we hope that this will lead to an international action.
Right. Well, the Geneva Convention bans the use of tear gas for war. Why is it not mandated for civilians?
Well, it really goes back to the Chemical Weapons Convention. And the time when it was negotiated in the 90s, there was a lot of pressure to ban the chemical weapons and their use in law enforcement. But that obviously got a pushback from many countries and say, well, we can't really give up this weapon because if we don't use tear gas, we will have to resort to more lethal weapons. The compromise that was reached was to kind of leave that option open for using the tear gas or the riot control agents in law enforcement and only in law enforcement.
What happens, though, when protests get violent? And, you know, some have argued that in violent protests, it's necessary in those cases to use tear gas. What are your thoughts on that?
One thing is that particularly when it comes to tear gas, it's we're not suggesting that it should never be deployed. The question is, when do you deploy that? When do you resort to that? And there has to be layers and layers of de-escalation steps and actions taken by law enforcement before you reach to that. And perhaps in the future, we'll have a federal government that will really do the right thing by changing the rules, amending the laws, and bringing this area under control.
Jamil Dakwar, head of the ACLU's Human Rights Program, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
Wildfires are sweeping through Russia this summer. They spread over huge areas of land in southern Siberia and even reach the Arctic Circle. Scientists are deeply concerned, and Russian authorities are declaring states of emergency. Mark Parrington is a senior scientist at CAMS, the Copernicus Atmosphere Monitoring Service in London. He says the fires in Siberia and the Arctic Circle are unusual.
In the data records that we have in the Copernicus program, which go back to 2003, we haven't seen such an extent or such a number of fires in that part of the world before. It's difficult to say with our data precisely the number of individual fires, but through the most active days, we've seen maybe 250 to 300 hotspots per day north of the Arctic Circle. And we can compare that against previous data that we have to be about 50 or 60. So it's substantially higher than what we'd expect to see. Generally, they're few and far between. You might see something above the average, but it only lasts for 1 or 2 days. What we've seen in this case is the fires that started in Sakha Republic around the 9th or 10th of June are essentially still going at the end of July.
What are the environmental factors that have contributed to that?
What was clear in June with the climate change monitoring that the Copernicus program does is that there was much warmer and drier conditions, particularly in the Sakha Republic part of the Arctic Circle where the initial fire was. We don't yet have the data for the July climate anomalies. Those will be released early next week. But I would expect that we would see similar patterns in the temperature and humidity anomalies that correspond with the rest of the fires we've seen across the Arctic Circle.
What are the health effects on the population of these areas?
So vegetation fires release a lot of pollutants into the air. The carbon gases and particulates will affect air quality quite severely. And there's a lot of other very toxic and harmful things. And so there's quite significant health impacts from the air quality locally. And also that smoke can be transported thousands of kilometers away, where it can also affect air quality.
There have also been reports that the fires are melting permafrost in the Arctic. What are the consequences of something like that?
If the permafrost was to melt, then obviously that's releasing more carbon gases into the atmosphere. It's changing the carbon cycle. Whether the fires themselves are melting the permafrost, it's difficult to say with our data. We do know that some of the fires are burning in places where there's a lot of peat soil. Again, this is releasing a lot of carbon into the atmosphere that's been accumulated over tens of thousands of years, potentially. And so this starts to become a serious consequence for climate, because this is an irreversible change in the carbon balance.
How are Russian officials dealing with these fires? Are crews from across the country converging on the blazes?
I believe that given the remoteness of the fires, particularly in the Arctic Circle, the resources and infrastructure may not be there to fight this. What I understand is that in parts of Russia, this is also true for parts of Canada and parts of the US, is that if these big fires aren't threatening infrastructure or population centers, then they're generally left to burn. But I did see something in the news today that there are efforts, particularly in Krasnoyarsk and Irkutsk, where the fires are closer to population centers, that there are now quite significant efforts to try to extinguish them.
And in the other areas, I mean, can these wildfires just burn themselves out naturally?
The idea would be that they would burn themselves out naturally. However, if the conditions are dry and warm, then those are the right conditions for the fires to persist and to continue. They'll burn themselves out when they run out of fuel or whenever there's weather systems and precipitation that could put them out.
Mark Parrington with the Copernicus Atmosphere Monitoring Service. Good to have you with us. Thanks.
Great to be here. Thank you.
News headlines are about a minute away. You're with The World.
In the latest season of the Things That Go Boom podcast, we explore why no one worries much about nuclear war anymore, and maybe why we should. Things That Go Boom unpacks the Iran nuclear deal, complete with secret missions, burial plots, a crying jag, and a false alarm about Armageddon. Things That Go Boom, a dramatic look at the 21st century nuclear threat. Get it where you grab your podcasts.
A State Department official quits because he says the White House is suppressing information about climate change.
When we weaken our foundational scientific base, we weaken our nation.
I'm Marco Werman. The connection between climate science and national security. That's still to come here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, PRI, and PRX. You'll remember scenes like this one off the coast of Italy 2 years ago.
It's now 8 o'clock in the morning, and yet another landing. There have been several in the night. This one is the Coast Guard's. It's a smallish boat, and it is jammed with rescued migrants. The first people off the boat seem very young.
That was the BBC's Emma Jane Kirby reporting in 2016 when 26,000 unaccompanied minors arrived in Italy. Today the numbers are way down, but we wondered what happened to the children who made that trip 2 years ago. The World's Orla Barry went to the Italian island of Sicily to meet two of them.
16-year-old Khadija and 15-year-old Marie are both from West Africa, but first met each other in Sicily. Khadija's from Guinea and Marie from Ivory Coast. They each travelled first to Libya, where they boarded migrant boats bound for southern Italy. Today, they're like sisters, so much so that the Italian authorities don't want to separate them. They speak Italian and French, but even with the help of an interpreter, they're reluctant to talk about what they've been through.
Can I ask, how did you arrive in Sicily?
Può chiederti come sei arrivata in Sicilia?
In a boat.
The two teenagers now have a legal guardian, thanks to a program organized by UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund. In reality, Maria Letizia Barone has become their substitute mother.
Often they
say, you are our mother now. You are our Italian mother.
And like any anxious mother, Barone worries about how much she can truly support the two teens.
Sometimes I feel, maybe I will not be able to answer the needs. So what can I do? What can I do? Am I doing right? Am I doing something wrong? Will I be good enough? I don't know.
Barone tells me that Khadija's parents and sister died in Guinea, which forced her to move in with an uncle. He refused to let her go to school. It was when he began making plans to marry her off to an older man that Khadija fled. She was 14. She began the long journey from Guinea through Mali, Mauritania, Algeria, and then to Libya.
She arrived to Libya. She was imprisoned. She was raped. And she became, for a period, a sex slave. I think she suffered too much. When she is by herself, she's very sad.
Khadija's friend Marie was only 13 when she left Ivory Coast. Barone says Marie's father had suddenly disappeared and her mother was struggling to cope, and so she sent Marie to live with some friends in Tunisia. From there, she made her way to Libya. I asked the two how they managed to get on a boat bound for Italy, but they don't tell me. A few weeks ago, Marie received some unexpected news.
She told me also, I feel sick very often. My breast is pain. Okay. So when I showed her the results of the test, please, can you read this? Incinta. What does it mean? Pregnant.
Pregnant.
She cried. And I told her, okay, this is the situation. But you have to know, I will be by your side. You will not be alone.
Marie has decided she'll go through with the pregnancy. It was her boyfriend who got her pregnant, and he has told her he'll stand by her.
Marie introduced her boyfriend, and then she left. And he told me, I will do whatever you want. What do you want me to do? If you want to be part of this, okay, you are welcome. But please respect Marie.
Despite what they've been through, Marie and Khadija are the fortunate ones. They have accommodation, at least for now, in a government-run centre, and they have a guardian. Many migrant children fall through the cracks. The Italian government has lost track of more than 4,700 migrant kids. Some may have left Italy for better job prospects in Northern Europe. UNICEF believes that others have left because of poor living conditions in Italian migrant centres. Aid workers are especially concerned about these runaway kids and say these are the ones most vulnerable to the risk of sex trafficking and other forms of exploitation. And there's another issue. The Italian government has passed a new law requiring many migrants to leave government accommodation when they turn 18. Many may, as a result, end up on the streets. For the moment, Khadija and Marie are still in school. I asked them what plans they have for the future. Marie says she'd like to be a hairdresser. And Khadija, who was prevented from going to school in Guinea, wants to continue her studies. Their guardian, Maria Letizia Barone, is hopeful the teenagers will be able to fulfil their dreams. But she worries that Khadija, in particular, will struggle to overcome what she's been through.
Because I see the past in the eyes. Fighting with the past will be the greatest challenge, I think.
And as for Barone,
I don't know how to say in English, but I told my family I am becoming una nonna adottiva.
Adopted grandmother.
Yeah. Yes, because it's like a grandchild.
And perhaps this new life will help them look towards the future and overcome some of the trauma of their past. For The World, I'm Orla Barry, Palermo, Sicily.
We have more stories of migrants living now in Sicily and how Italy's so-called security decree has made life increasingly difficult for them. That's at theworld.org. One way or another, the United Kingdom is planning to leave the European Union at the end of October with or without a deal. That's got some people wondering just how long the kingdom itself will remain united. On Monday, the First Minister of Scotland, Nicola Sturgeon, said that Scotland will try to break away from the UK if there's a no deal with the EU. Then today, the leader Sinn Féin in Northern Ireland said the party would seek a referendum also to leave the UK. Northern Ireland is the only part of the UK to share a land border with an EU country. That country would be the Irish Republic, just to its south. In both the north and the south, there is great concern that the return of a hard border would be bad for all of Ireland. Fintan O'Toole is a columnist with the Irish Times and the author of Heroic Failure, Brexit and the Politics of Pain. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson was in Belfast today. He says he's ready to leave the EU without any kind of deal governing trade or anything else. No ifs, ands, or buts. How does that affect Ireland?
Well, it affects it very badly. It's I think, seen by most people in both parts of Ireland as grossly irresponsible. You have to understand that the Belfast Agreement, also called the Good Friday Agreement, which was made in 1998, is a pre-existing international treaty. This is not just a sort of casual piece of British law. This is a sovereign international treaty registered with the United Nations between Ireland and the UK, and also involves, it's a multi-party agreement within Northern Ireland. It finished a conflict that some of us thought would never end, a conflict that had gone on for 30 years. It's an incredible achievement. And Boris Johnson seems to not understand it at all, or if he does understand it, to have very little interest in it.
Sinn Féin is trying to get a referendum on the table. What would the referendum entail, and how likely would that solve things?
Yeah, so there's no doubt, you mentioned in your introduction that Brexit is putting huge strain on the whole idea of the United Kingdom itself, Scotland, Northern Ireland, maybe even Wales. So in relation to Northern Ireland, because of the agreement in 1998, Northern Ireland has the right at any time, this is agreed by everybody, including the British, to leave the United Kingdom and join with the Republic of Ireland to create a single Irish state, which is, of course, what Irish nationalists have always wanted. But the safeguard is that this has to be passed by a majority in Northern Ireland. And also, incidentally, it also would have to be agreed to by a majority in the Republic of Ireland, right? Mm. So what Sinn Féin is saying is, we want this so-called border poll, this is the term is given to it, we want it now. Brexit is causing so much trouble that we think there is now a possibility that a lot of Protestants in Northern Ireland who would traditionally have been opposed to leaving the United Kingdom might now be willing to do this. My own view is that this is highly unrealistic still. I think the view of most people is, you don't want to be doing this huge thing in the middle of all this Brexit chaos, and Brexit could be chaotic for another few years yet. We really don't know where this is going. In the long term, I think there's little doubt that Brexit, if it goes ahead, will undermine the union and will create, much more demand for United Ireland. But I think Sinn Féin is grandstanding somewhat, in terms of saying we want this now. It's their traditional position. I don't think it's realistic. The fact is, we still are going to have to deal with the border question.
Would the government in Dublin and the Republic of Ireland even welcome Northern Ireland if its people voted to join the Republic?
That's a great question. In principle, there's no question that the Irish government and most people, I think, in the Republic of Ireland, in principle, want a united Ireland, right? I think there's no question but that most people would like to see partition ended. However, it's one question to ask people, would you like a united Ireland? It's another question to ask them, would you like a united Ireland now, with all the chaos of Brexit, with the majority of people at least a very large minority of people in Northern Ireland, the Protestant minority, as it would be in this case, very, very angry, very strongly opposed to United Ireland, no real reconciliation within the communities in Northern Ireland. I think in those circumstances, most people would say no. Also, to be very prosaic about it, the British state subsidizes Northern Ireland to a huge extent. The Irish state, I think, either couldn't, but even if it could, probably wouldn't do that. So there are lots of real practical questions about a united Ireland, I think, which need to be answered before people will embrace it.
So your book on Brexit, Fintan, is called Heroic Failure. What is the premise in 30 seconds or less?
Well, it's really a book about Englishness, and it's trying to argue, in a sense, that this thing is not about Europe. It's about unresolved psychological problems, in a way, that the English in particular, not the British, but the English have with the Second World War. They're still fighting the Second World War. You know, you listen to the language about the Blitz spirit and the Dunkirk spirit and this stuff still going on. And, of course, the other thing that's unresolved is the legacy of empire. You know, we thought this was all over, but it turns out it has a kind of zombie afterlife. So that's essentially what the book tries to explore.
Fintan O'Toole, Irish Times columnist and author of Heroic Failure, Brexit, and the Politics of Pain. Thanks very much for your thoughts or your explanations. Really appreciate it.
Real pleasure talking to you.
We have a birth announcement for you. He's a boy, 125 pounds. He's a southern white rhino at the San Diego Zoo. His mother, Victoria, gave birth through artificial insemination, which is a big deal. But this birth is also an important step towards saving a far more endangered species. Barbara Durant is the director of reproductive sciences at the San Diego Zoo. So, first of all, how's mom and baby?
Mom and baby are doing great. The calf is up and around, nursing frequently. His feet and ears are enormous for the rest of him. He will grow into them. He does have a tiny little horn bud at the end of his nose, the big square lip that's characteristic of the white rhino. And to me and everyone who has worked with these animals, he's the most beautiful thing we've ever seen.
Why did you decide to artificially inseminate Victoria? Was she having problems conceiving?
No, not at all. We brought six southern white rhinos from South Africa for the express purpose of understanding in great detail their reproductive process, their estrous cycle, how they grow follicles, when they ovulate, because the long-term plan for those females is to be embryo recipients for northern white rhinos. So we will be making the northern white rhino embryos in the lab, but then we need to have these females, the southern white rhino females, to act as surrogates. And we want to make sure that we are putting these embryos into southern white rhinos that are proven females. So proven meaning that they can conceive, can carry a fetus to term, can give birth, and can raise that calf.
My understanding is that there are several thousand southern white rhinos. How many northern white rhinos are there in the world?
There are two, a mother and a daughter. They're considered the most endangered mammal on the planet.
Why can't a southern white rhino just mate with the two remaining female northern white rhinos?
Well, that was the plan. And, of course, that would produce a hybrid, which was not the desired result, but it would at least capture the northern white rhino genes, half of those genes. But in fact, those females did not breed.
So how close are you, do you think, from the first baby northern white rhino through this form of IVF?
If everything in the lab and with the rhinos went perfectly the first time we tried it, which of course that's not going to happen, I would say probably 5 to 10 years at the very earliest.
Dr. Barbara Durant is the Henshaw Endowed Director of Reproductive Sciences at the San Diego Zoo. A southern white rhino has been born there following artificial insemination, and that's raising hopes of bringing a different rhino species back from extinction. Dr. Durant, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
And in case you were wondering what a baby white rhino sounds like, we got you covered. I'm guessing he's hungry. You're with the world. A State Department official resigned this month after he says the White House blocked him from submitting scientific evidence about climate change. He spoke publicly for the first time this week.
The testimony was blocked because of its content of science. And that feels like suppression of science.
The World's Environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler is here to tell us more. This was Rod Schoonover, Carolyn. He's a 10-year veteran of the State Department. What exactly happened?
So last month, Schoonover, who's a scientist, was set to speak at a House Intelligence Committee hearing on the impact of climate change on national security. And he submitted written testimony ahead of time. And in a pretty unusual move, the White House refused to approve it.
What was he planning to say?
His testimony outlined how climate change is connected to national security threats. So he talked about how climate change might increase humanitarian crises and migration and fuel tension over natural resources. So things that have been talked about for a while about how climate change is a so-called threat multiplier. But the comments that came from administration officials onto this testimony, which the New York Times published, questioned the established scientific consensus that Schoonover cites in his report. One of those comments said a consensus of peer-reviewed literature has nothing to do with truth.
Wow. So was Schoonover ultimately allowed to testify?
He was at the last minute allowed to speak, but he was not allowed to submit the longer written testimony into the congressional record where it would have lived as a historical document. And Schoonover then resigned from the State Department a few weeks ago. He said he and his colleagues no longer had what he calls analytic independence. He mentioned this yesterday at an event at the World Resources Institute in Washington, D.C.
Our national security rests on scientific integrity. And so I think that when we weaken our foundational scientific base, we weaken our nation.
I reached out to the State Department for comment on this, and they referred me to the White House, which says it doesn't comment on its internal policy review.
So we know President Trump has not been a champion of climate science, called climate change a hoax on the campaign trail. Is any of this surprising?
Yes and no. Watchdog groups that are tracking the Trump administration's actions on climate science say this is part of a trend of sidelining and burying climate science. Another example of this is a National Park Service employee who lost her job this year after fighting hard to get a report that she wrote published. That report was on the impact of sea level rise on coastal parks. And Schoonover says he wasn't the only one in the State Department or other intelligence agencies to leave.
So what I have watched in this administration have been really talented civil servants who may not even agree with the policy that is being pushed, but nonetheless try their best to execute that policy, and at the same time try to eke out as many wins for the American people. So I would say that attacking or suppressing or undermining climate science, it makes an already difficult situation more difficult.
Carolyn, aside from a handful of key departures of these climate scientists, what are watchdog groups seeing in terms of other worrying trends within the government?
They've tracked the removal of climate change information from public-facing websites. So one watchdog group has found that about a quarter of the mentions of the word climate change and similar terms have been removed across thousands of government websites. The administration has also tried to bury national climate reports. And the EPA is working to change a rule that would end up limiting the kinds of scientific information that can be used to back up EPA rulemaking. So critics of the administration see this as a worrying trend.
So in that way, what's happened here, the apparent blocking of this climate report from being entered into the congressional record, it's part of what seems like a trend, both in terms of climate denialism as well as an administration standing in the way of dissenting points of view, even truths that they disagree with. So what about this is surprising?
This is surprising because it's happening in the intelligence space. The military and intelligence communities have been among the most forward-looking when it comes to incorporating climate change planning into policymaking. So, for example, for more than a decade, including under this current administration, the director of the National Intelligence's Office has included climate change in this annual report it does, the Worldwide Threat Assessment. Mm. So the fact that an intelligence official is getting flack for his assessments of risks posed by climate change, that surprised people within these worlds. People like Francesco Femi at the Center for Climate and Security.
It's surprising that that intelligence analysis would be interfered with. That's quite unprecedented. We haven't seen many examples of that happening in history.
Quite unprecedented. The world's Carolyn Beeler. Thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
A quick note before we go, call it a photo finish. In one part of southern India, some young couples are spending big bucks on wedding videos designed to go viral. In fact, they're devoting more time to the video and photo shoots than the weddings themselves. Here's the BBC's Anuba George in Kerala.
It's late afternoon, and it's a humid one. In front of me is a photographer and his team of 10 assistants. Some are holding lights, some are setting cameras at different angles. It looks like a film shoot, but the actors are yet to arrive. And here they are, the bride and groom. She is dressed in a red sari with a gold blouse, lots of jewelry, big earrings, bangles, necklace and rings. He is wearing a black silk shirt and a white munda, a sarong-like clothing for men in Kerala.
Hi, I'm Abhijit.
I'm Naina.
And we are here for the post-wedding shoot.
Actually, this is something different.
It's 15 days on from their wedding. That was a simple Hindu ceremony which lasted just 15 minutes. But this wedding shoot will last all day. They're in the middle of a pond. There are lotus flowers all around them. There's fake rain pouring on them from a water pipe high above. The idea is to create romantic pictures and videos of a newly married couple getting intimate in the rain in a lush landscape. Shahin Siddharth is the man in charge of this elaborate video shoot.
This is the current trend. We intend to make the couple go viral on social media. What you get are photos that you have never seen before.
Well, the directors just told me there's another 5 hours to go. He's telling the newlyweds to look at each other romantically, to hold hands. It must be exhausting for this marathon shoot.
Wow, I can only imagine. The BBC's Anuba George there in Kerala, India. That'll do it for us today. Our theme music was composed by Ned Porter. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you all tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.